Hi, my name's Chris, and this is season 3 of My Life, and welcome to it, Seeking God's Face. Okay, now welcome back to part 2 of the Eucharist. And you know, it's funny, it's been a minute since I've been here talking with you. Thought a lot about it, putting it all together. Today I took some time and put some notes on paper. And interestingly enough, let me adjust my mic a little bit. Interestingly enough, I'm a little bit nervous, believe it or not. But anyway, this is going to focus on the sacrificial aspect of the Eucharist. And but before we get to that, I want to share a little bit. A couple of years ago, in the time between lying down and falling asleep, in those moments, I would contemplate time and the nature of time. And what is time? And I did some what I would call thought experiments. You know, I've always been impressed with Albert Einstein and how he was able to come up with his general theory of relativity and his special theory of relativity using thought experiments. So I thought I'd give it a go. And the first thing I thought of in trying to understand what time is looking at it as what would it be like to not have any time at all. And every time I've seen a depiction of time stopping, all motion stops. Everything stops. The world stops. The universe stops. Everything stops. There's no motion whatsoever. So that made me think time and motion are connected. Time and movement are connected. Without movement, there's no time. And then I got to thinking about, even if we're standing still, we're still moving, right? We're standing on a planet that's revolving around an axis. That planet is revolving around the sun, and the sun is revolving around the center of the galaxy, and the galaxy is moving through space. So there's lots of movement taking place, so it's impossible to actually stop time, stand still. Then I thought, you know, what would it be like if I was in a spacesuit out in space, just floating around and facing away from any light source? Would I have any perception of time? I mean, there's no day-night cycle. There's nothing to anchor that time on. The passing of time would be completely subjective, and I know that in my day-to-day life, if I'm bored, time goes slowly. Well, the perception of time goes slowly. And if I'm engaged, the perception of time goes quickly. So that's basically what it would be about if I'm in a if I'm out in space in a spacesuit and I don't have any reference, that my experience of time would be completely subjective as to whether it's long or short. I wouldn't know how much time I've spent in space. But I would still probably experience time because I would be moving. Even if I was able to use a little jets, right, to stop all motion of my body, I'm still moving, right? You've got the vibration of the atoms in my body. You've got the circulation of my blood. You've got my respiratory. You know, there's all kinds of things about me that's moving, even if I'm still. So there would still be a perception of time, albeit, you know, I might live longer, because the if there, and I don't even know if there is an absolute time or an objective time. So who knows? So those are some of the ideas I was sort of playing with. I've always found time interesting. My very favorite science fiction shows have a time element, whether it's time travel or something, right? And most of the time, I'm disappointed because time travel is very, very hard to do. Very hard. When they get it close to being right, it's absolutely fantastic. There's a movie called Primer. If you ever get a chance to see it, I would encourage you to do so because it's pretty excellent. The reason I bring that up is because time is really important when we're dealing with what happens during the liturgy. The memorial and the sacrifice of the Passion of Christ on the altar during the Mass. Time, our perception of it, our understanding of it, plays an integral part. So I bring that up. You know, when I was going to be confirmed, one of the things that the Catholic Church encourages is that we adopt a saint's name for our confirmation. And so, as I was contemplating, now my name's Christian, that's a pretty good name to start with. But as I contemplated it, I thought, who are two of my favorite authors of the church? Not contemporary, but throughout time. And one was St. Augustine of Hippo, and one was St. Thomas Aquinas. So I said, hey, can I have two names? And of course they said, okay, sure. And so I picked Thomas Augustine. So that's my confirmation name, Thomas Augustine. And St. Augustine of Hippo was writing at the end of the 4th century, the end of the 300s, and he wrote his biography called Confessions, and it's probably the first time that anyone had ever attempted something like that, or it was an actual biography that dealt with the person of himself. One of the interesting pieces of his Confessions, his biography, is he writes about time. And it's in, it's in book 9 of the Confessions. It begins with chapter 12. And I'm not going to read the whole thing because it's not super long, but it's long enough. And it's written in a style that's centuries old. So it's kind of hard to follow at times. But I made some notes as to where I want to read. So we're going to go down here. It says paragraph. There's paragraph numbers, and that helps. So we're going to start with paragraph 16. It's in chapter 8. The chapter has a title. The title is Before the Times Created by God, Times Were Not. Oh, here we go. This is fascinating. Anyway, he starts off by saying, I'll get the paragraph right before that. He writes, but if before heaven and earth there was no time, why is it asked, what did you, capital Y, talking of God, what did you then? For there was no then, when time was not. Okay, paragraph 16. Nor did you precede time by any time, because then you would not precede all times. But in the excellency of an ever-present eternity, you precede all times past and survive all future times, because they are future, and when they have come, they will be past. But, and in quotation marks, you are the same, and your years shall have no end. unquote. Your years neither come nor go, but ours both go and come, that all may come. You have made all time, and before all times you are, nor in any time was there not time. Yeah, did you follow that? Okay. Then it goes into paragraph 17. Title, it's in chapter 14. And the chapter title is Neither Time Past Nor Future, But the Present Only Really Is. At no time, therefore, had you not made anything, because you made time itself. And no times are co-eternal with you, because you remain forever. But should these continue, they would not be times. For what is time? Who can easily and briefly explain it? Who even in thought can comprehend it, even to the pronouncing of a word concerning it? But what in speaking do we refer to more familiarly? Let me say that again. But what in speaking do we refer to more familiarly and knowingly than time? And certainly we understand that when we speak of it, we understand also when we hear it spoken of by another. What then is time? If no one asks me, I know. If I wish to explain to him who asks, I know not. Yet I say with confidence that I know that if nothing passed away, there would not be past time. And if nothing were coming, there would not be future time. And if nothing were, there would not be present time. Those two times, therefore, past and future, how are they? Even when even the past now is not, and the future is not as yet. But should the present be always present, and should it not pass into time past, time truly it could not be, but eternity. If then time present, if it be time, only comes into existence because it passes into time past, how do we say that even this is whose cause of being is that it shall not be? Namely, so that we cannot truly say what time is, unless because it tends not to be. Okay, well, that's a real mind twister, that is. Basically, he said that I know what it is. I know what time is, as long as you don't ask me what it is. If someone says time, I know what that means. If I say time, I know what that means. But if you ask me what it means and ask me to explain it, I can't do that. That's something I can't do. He talks about eternity. It was a very interesting thought. That, where is this here? I know that if nothing passed away, there would not be past time. And if nothing were coming, there would not be future time. But should the present be always present, and should it not pass into time past, time truly it could not be, but eternity. In other words, eternity is the present moment that never passes into time past. And that's beyond our experience. That's beyond our understanding. All time passes into time past. Always does. And time future always comes to us as time present. Crazy stuff, right? I also got marked here paragraph 23. Let's see what that is all about here. This is in chapter 13. Past and future times cannot be thought of but as present. Okay. Paragraph 23. If there are times past and future, I desire to know where they are. But if as yet I do not succeed, I still know, wherever they are, that they are not there as future or past, but as present. For if there also they be future, they are not as yet there. And even if they And even, okay, this is hard for me to read. This is old stuff, right? For if there also they be future, they are not as yet there. If even there they be past, they are no longer there. Wherever therefore they are, whatsoever they are only so as present. Although past things are related as true, they are drawn out from the memory, not the things themselves, which have passed, but the words conceived from their image of the things which they have formed in the mind as footprints in their passage through the senses. My childhood indeed, which no longer is in time past, which now is not. But when I call to mind its image and speak of it, I behold it in the present, because it is as yet in my memory. Whether there is a like cause of foretelling future things, that of things which as yet are not the images may be perceived as already existing, I confess, my God, I know not. This certainly I know, that we generally think before on our future actions, and that this premeditation is present, but that the action we premeditate is not yet, because it is future. And when we have begun to do that which we were premeditating, then shall that action be, because then it is not future, but present. And then the last paragraph, a little short, one sentence, two, of this chapter. In whatever manner, therefore, this secret preconception of future things may be, nothing can be seen save what is. But what is now is present, not future. And I'm going to leave it at that. There's more to be said. There's more that he writes. But the thing that I found most interesting here was that nothing exists but the present. Even things that have passed into the past by memory are brought back into the present. Those memories don't exist in the past. Those memories exist in the present. Which I think has direct bearing. When we celebrate the sacred liturgy of the Mass, we remember the Passion of Christ. And that memory brings it into the present. It's kind of weird, kind of hard to explain. When I start thinking about the Holy Eucharist, Holy Communion, the words that we use, take, eat, this is my body that's been given for you, or broken for you, or whatever, however you want to put it down, that comes from what's known as the Last Supper. It's a supper that Jesus shared with his 12 disciples just prior to his being arrested. And he says what have become known as the words of institution. Paul uses these same words in writing to the Corinthians. These are words that were used in the Paschal meal, in the celebration and the remembrance of Christ's passion, his death, burial, and resurrection. It was that offering. But Christ did this. He started it before the case, before it happened. Now, how was that? Was this simply a symbolic foretelling of what was going to happen? Or when he said it, did he mean it? And something truly happened there. In that upper room, on the night of which he was betrayed. If we look at time, and we look at eternity. Eternity, you know, when you've got, you know, a Venn diagram is, you got two circles, let's say, and they overlap, right? You've got the distinct parts of the circle, and then you've got the overlap parts. Time and eternity do not overlap. Eternity and time do not coexist in any material way. There's time, and there's eternity. God exists outside of time and space. God created time and space when he created creation. Which is why St. Augustine says it's ridiculous to say, what did God do before he created anything? Because there was no time. There was no before. There's no such thing as before, because there's no time passing. So, during the Words of Institution, there is a thinning of the veil, let's say, and that which has existed in eternity is brought into time. Because time works from moment to moment, it's brought to a specific moment. There's some interesting things in Scripture. We're going to talk about St. Aquinas, Thomas Aquinas also, my two favorite saints, Aquinas and Augustine. But before we do that, one of the things that's important to me, having been raised in a Protestant Christian setting, is the Bible. The Bible is really, really important. If it doesn't say it in the Bible, then there's got to be a pretty doggone good reason for it to be there. It's not enough just to say, well, that's how we've always done it. That's how we've always understood it. There's a couple of things I want to share with you. One is out of the Old Testament, the Hebrew Scriptures. And this is in, it's in Exodus. And it's in chapter 25. So what do we have here? So in chapter 25, we've got God explaining to Moses how to build the things that he wants built for the tabernacle, right? So that as the children of Israel are traveling through the desert, they have a place of worship. And he was very specific on a lot of things. But what's interesting is a sentence that he says. This is chapter 25, verse 40. And he writes, or God says to Moses, he says, see that you make them according to the pattern shown you on the mountain. So this is Mount Horeb, right? Where God appeared in thunder and lightning and a dark cloud. And Moses got the Ten Commandments. And God showed him all these things as to how to build. And it's very, very much in detail. It also goes into the book of Hebrews, which is in the New Testament. This particular sentence is quoted. This is in chapter 8 of Hebrews, and it's talking about the priesthood of Jesus. And starting in verse 1 of chapter 8 in Hebrews, it says this. The main point of what has been said is this. We have such a high priest who has taken his seat at the right hand of the throne of the majesty in heaven, a minister of the sanctuary and of the true tabernacle that the Lord, not man, set up. Now every high priest is appointed to offer gifts and sacrifices. Thus the necessity for this one also to have something to offer. if then he were on earth, he would not be a priest, since there are those who offer gifts according to the law. They worship in a copy and shadow of the heavenly sanctuary, as Moses was warned when he was about to erect the tabernacle. For he says, "See that you make everything according to the pattern shown you on the mountain." Now he has obtained so much more excellent a ministry, as he is mediator of a better covenant, enacted on better promises. What have we got here? This is deep. This is profound. Moses, I don't know when Moses lived. No idea. What, 6,000 years ago? 4,000 years ago? Somewhere in there, probably. I guess. No one really knows for sure. But in any event, God showed Moses a pattern. And Moses then built something tangible here on earth based on the pattern that he was shown. And in the book of Hebrews, in the New Testament, the insinuation here is that this was a heavenly sanctuary, that Moses saw the heavenly sanctuary where Jesus is the high priest. And what does the high priest do? The high priest makes an offering of a sacrifice. And that offering of the sacrifice was Christ himself, as he offered himself on the cross. So that's what he's doing. That's what he's doing up there. So there's some Bible there for you, and I think we're going to look at some other Bible verses before we're done here, to show that there's scriptural evidence for what I'm sharing as far as the Eucharist being a sacrifice, that the bread and the wine becoming the body and blood of Christ is truly a sacrifice. So what else do we have here? What have I written down? Okay. One of the books I like to use as I was beginning to understand the faith for myself, you know, and this is my life and welcome to it. And I am having to embrace these ideas, or at least start wrestling with them intellectually and in my heart, because not everything of God can be comprehended intellectually. Some we only comprehend in faith. Well, one of the books that I used early on was the Catechism of the Catholic Church. And I thought to myself, you know, hey, there's two things I need to read before I start looking at becoming a Catholic. I think I've shared this in the past. One was I need to read The City of God by St. Augustine. And I still haven't finished it. And it's been, you know, 14 years, 12 years, 13. Wait, let's see, 2007 to 2017 is 10 to 2022 is 4 or 5 more years. So it's 15 years. And I haven't finished it. It's been sitting, it's not that it's taking me a long time to read. It's that I haven't picked it up and finished it. I'm mostly done. I'm looking at it right now. I'm about 3/4 of the way through. I just haven't read it in years. So at some point, I'll pick it up and give it a go, give it a finish. The other book that I thought would be important to read would be The Seven Story Mountain by Thomas Merton, which is his life story. I'd heard of Thomas Merton. I'd heard of The Seven Story Mountain. So one day, I went to the mall, downtown mall. This is before the renovation, the most recent renovation. And there was Borders? I think it was Borders Books, a little bookstore, a little tiny bookstore. So I walked in there, and there's a little religion section. And yes, indeed, they had, what did they have? They had the Seven Story Mountain. They did not have City of God. But what they also had was the Catechism of the Catholic Church. And I thought, well, hey, this contains all the teachings of the church. I'll read that. So I did. So I got it. As a catechist, I also use this in preparing the lessons for the topics that I'm sharing with people who are wanting to become either Catholic Christians, be baptized, or as they are wanting to be received into the church from another Christian denomination. And so I will often pull this book out, just to see if there's something in there that's pertinent. And today, yes, there was. There was a whole section on time. And there's lots of ways that the catechism, which is what I'll refer to it as from here on out, talks about time. The word time is used in many different contexts. You know, what time is it? Is it time to put the turkey in the oven? What, you know, the time could be like the season. But, you know, this is the time of fall, you know. But when it comes to the nature of time, there's not a lot. It doesn't actually say a lot, but it does say some stuff. So let me get my notes out here and so that I can read them. There you go. Okay. And there's a couple of really cool ones. Now, the catechism is put together by paragraph numbers. One of the things, and this is where the church is really smart. If you're using a book as a reference tool, instead of page numbers, because every edition tends to have different page numbers. But if you use paragraph numbers, those don't change. Okay, so we're at paragraph number 1367, and it talks about sacrifice. The general topic is the Eucharist, the sacrament of the Eucharist. And this is how it explains it. The sacrifice of Christ and the sacrifice of the Eucharist are one single sacrifice, quotation. The victim is one and the same. The same now offers through the ministry of priests, who then offered himself on the cross. Only the manner of offering is different, unquote. The next quote. And since in this divine sacrifice, which is celebrated in the Mass, the same Christ who offered himself once in a bloody manner on the altar of the cross is contained and offered in an unbloody manner. ... This sacrifice is truly propitiatory, unquote. And that's from the Council of Trent. And of course, propitiatory means that it actually acts as an offering before God in the sense of forgiveness. And it uses a word in the previous paragraph, represents, not represents, but represents, which means to make present. The paragraph before that, 1366, the Eucharist is thus a sacrifice because it represents, parentheses, makes present, the sacrifice of the cross, because it is its memorial, and because it applies its fruit. And it's got another quote from the Council of Trent, which I'm not going to read. And there were some other ones that I thought were cool, and I've circled them. One's real near the front. It's paragraph 205. So that's super near the front. And it's talking about how God represents himself to Moses through the burning bush. It says this. God calls Moses from the midst of a bush that burns without being consumed. Quotation. I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. Unquote. Okay. God is the God of the fathers, the one who has called, who had called and guided the patriarchs in their wanderings. He is the faithful and compassionate God who remembers them and his promises. He comes to free their descendants from slavery. He is the God who, from beyond space and time, can do this and wills to do it. The God who will put his almighty power to work for this plan. He is the God who, from beyond space and time. It's kind of cool. It's God from beyond space and time interjects himself into space and time to do things. That's pretty cool. All right. Next one up I have. I'm just going to read these to you. You can digest them as you wish. And if you so choose, you can pick up a copy of the Catechism and read it yourself. You know, a lot of people reject Catholicism, but they don't really. I forget who it was. I think G.K. Chesterton said, people don't reject Catholicism. They reject what they think Catholicism is. So, read it for yourself. It's the best way to do things, I think. Go to the source and read it yourself. Paragraph 600. To God, all moments of time are present in their immediacy. It's going to go talk on about predestination here. When, therefore, he establishes his eternal plan of, quote, predestination, unquote, he includes in it each person's free response to his grace. Quote, in this city, in fact, both Herod and Pontius Pilate, with the Gentiles and the peoples of Israel, gathered together against your holy servant Jesus, whom you anointed to do whatever your hand and your plan had predestined to take place. Unquote. And that's from, let me look here, taken from the book of Acts. For the sake of accomplishing his plan of salvation, God permitted the acts that flowed from their blindness. But, what does it say? All starts off by saying to God, all moments of time are present in their immediacy. So when Jesus at that Last Supper said, take, eat, this is my body, which was given for you, he's talking about the cross, which has not happened yet. But because for God, all moments are present. Christ is able to bring that future moment into the present. Right? As a future event, it does not exist. But it can be brought into the present moment. St. Augustine talked about whether we could do that or not. And he said, I don't know if we can do that or not. We can bring the past into the present through memory, but can we bring the future into the present? Don't know. But Jesus, being both fully God and fully man, was able to do it. Let's see what else we have here. This is some good stuff. And I'm going to go a little bit long today, it looks like. So just, bear with me. We're going to go into 1165. See what 1165 has to say. When the church celebrates the mystery of Christ, there is a word that marks her prayer. Quote, "Today!" exclamation mark, unquote. A word echoing the prayer her Lord taught her and the call of the Holy Spirit. This, quote, "today," unquote, of the living God which man is called to enter is the hour, quote unquote, of Jesus' Passover, which reaches across and underlies all history. And then there's a quotation here from Saint Hippolytus. He lived in either the first or second century, I guess second century. I think he lived in the second century. And the end of that says, "Therefore, a day of long, eternal light is ushered in for us who believe in him, a day which is never blotted out, the mystical Passover." In other words, it's a day where the sun never sets. It's an eternal day. That's kind of cool. I think that's kind of cool. And then the last one that I'm going to share is near the end of the catechism. It is paragraph 2836. Also talking about a today kind of scenario, says this, quote, "This day," unquote, "is also an expression of trust taught us by the Lord, which we would never have presumed to invent. Since it refers above all to his word, capital W, and to the body, capital B, of his son, capital S, this, quote, today, unquote, is not only that of our mortal time, but also the, quote, today, unquote, of God." And then there's a bit of a little quote here from St. Ambrose, which reads thus, "If you receive the bread each day is today for you. If Christ is yours today, he rises for you every day. How can this be? Quote, you are my son. Today I have begotten you," unquote. Therefore, quote, "today," unquote, is when Christ rises. So the today of God can be every day. It can be every day. This is all very cool stuff. Very, very cool stuff. There's a piece of St. Thomas Aquinas. You know, St. Thomas Aquinas, he lived in the period of Scholasticism. I believe it was the 13th century, maybe 14th century. And a lot of what they did was try to explain rationally the teachings of the church and some of the doctrines of the church. And he spoke about the Holy Eucharist. The Pope at the time, I think it was Pope Gregory, one of the Pope Gregories, asked St. Thomas to actually compose a liturgy. And for what was called Corpus Christi, or the body of Christ. And he did. He also wrote a very, very long treatise called the Summa Theologica, and apparently in that he never talks about the Eucharist being sacrifice. And some people, he received some criticism for that, but he wrote about it in other spots. And so I'm going to read some of this. I'm reading from The Hidden Manna, A Theology of the Eucharist, which I've read from before. This is on page 197. And, the writer says, Aquinas clearly held that the Eucharist was a sacrifice and refers to it as such many times. Nonetheless, he devoted not one question and only one article to that aspect of the Eucharist in his entire treatment of the sacrament in his Summa Theologiae. I don't know, good old Latin. Okay. It says that the criticism fails to understand his profound approach to the sacrament. For St. Thomas, the sacrificial aspect of the Eucharist is sacramental and largely depends upon the presence and the real presence we've talked about, right? The sacrifice of Christ is present symbolically, its efficacy made present in and through the true presence of the priest and victim who had undergone the sacrifice once and for all. He wrote, this is St. Thomas Aquinas, "It must be said that the celebration of this sacrament is said to be the sacrifice of Christ in two ways. First, as St. Augustine says in his letter to Simplicianus, or something like that, it is customary for the symbols of things to be called by the name of the things for which they are symbols. As when looking at a picture on a table or a wall, we say, it is Cicero, or it is Sallust. The celebration of this sacrament, as we have already said, is a kind of representative symbol of the Passion of Christ, which is a true sacrifice. In a second way, Christ is said to be sacrificed in the celebration in respect to the effect of his passion. Through this sacrament, we are made sharers of the fruits of the Lord's passion. Therefore, in one of the Sunday orations or the offerings, it is said, quote, as often as the commemoration of this victim is celebrated, the work of our redemption is effected, unquote. How about that? I'm just kind of looking here to see if there's anything else I want to read here. Yeah, let's read some more. So the author of the book says, when St. Thomas, following Augustine, calls the Mass a sacrifice in the sense that it is a representative symbol of Christ's passion, it must not be thought that he is saying it is a mere commemoration or even a mere symbolic sacrifice. Although the, quote, sacrament is the sign of Christ's passion and not the passion itself, unquote, the sacrament truly contains the, quote, Christ who has suffered, unquote. And here he quotes St. Thomas directly. This sacrament is said to be a sacrifice inasmuch as it represents the very passion of Christ. Moreover, it is a victim. The Latin word there is hostia, which is where we get the word host, which is what is used during the Eucharist, the Latin Mass. It is a victim inasmuch as it contains Christ himself, who is, as Ephesians 5:2 tells us, a fragrant sacrifice. He goes on to quote St. Augustine, therefore it was necessary that the sacrifice of the new covenant instituted by Christ have something more, namely that it contain Christ himself who has suffered and contain him not only in symbol but in reality. One of the things that we're taught is that Christ died once and for all. That's one of the criticisms of the Catholic faith, understanding of the Eucharist, that it is a sacrifice. Because if Christ died once and for all, then how could it happen on the altar every time you celebrate the Mass? Part of our understanding is to do with time that we have discussed. There's a couple more scriptures I want to share, which really kind of makes one think a little bit deeper as to what's really going on here in regards to time. And let me just grab this here. I'll have to edit out this dead air. Okay. Pull up my little Bible here. We're going to go to the book of Revelation. And I would call it the book of Revelation, but it's kind of a misnomer. It's actually, the name Revelation comes from the first chapter, right? First verse in the first chapter. The revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave to him to show his servants what must happen soon. And the word apocalypse simply means revelation, right? So that's what this is. So anyway, we want to go to chapter 5. Chapter 5, verse 6. The writer of Revelation, and tradition says it's St. John, the disciple of Christ. He's explaining a vision that he had, what he saw, right? He says something really, really interesting. Then I saw, standing in the midst of the throne, and the four living creatures, and the elders, a lamb that seemed to have been slain. So he's in a heavenly realm of some sort. Decades after the actual crucifixion. And yet, what does he see? He sees a lamb that seems to have been slain. Okay. And there's that. The elders fell down before the lamb. There was worship. They were worshiping the lamb. Obviously, this was Christ. This was Jesus who was slain. Now, let's just go to chapter 13, where we go to verse 8, and we read this. All the inhabitants of the earth will worship it. All whose names were not written from the foundation of the world in the book of life. So he's talking about this dragon, this beast, this Antichrist. And all the inhabitants of the world will worship it, except for those whose names were not written from the foundation of the world in the book of life, which belongs to the Lamb who was slain. Okay, these names were written from the foundation of the world in the book of life, which belongs to the Lamb who was slain. Okay, so that gets kind of wild here. So it's really something when you stop to think about what's happening here. The names of these people were written in a book of life before the foundations of the world, which indicates before creation? I don't know. And it was owned by the Lamb that was slain. Which seems to indicate that the Lamb who was slain has existed for all time. Before time. Outside of time. And that Christ, in Hebrews 7, Hebrews is a wonderful book. Begin to understand what's happening in a heavenly way in the worship in heaven, at heavenly worship. Chapter 7 of Hebrews talks about Jesus as a priest like Melchizedek. He's a priest forever. And some interesting things here. A forever priest, what does the, know, when you're looking in the context of the priests, of the Levitical priests, what was their job? Their job was to offer sacrifice before the Lord. That was their job. And Christ, as the high priest in heaven, that's his job, is to offer the sacrifice, which is himself, offering himself. It says here, those priests, talking about the Levitical priests, were many because they were prevented by death from remaining in office. But he, speaking of Christ, Jesus, because he remains forever, has a priesthood that does not pass away. Therefore, he is always able to save those who approach God through him, since he lives forever to make intercession for them. So this offering, this sacrifice that was done once and for all people, is something that Christ offers to God continually. It doesn't mean he's continually suffering on the cross. Of course not. But that offering that he presented before God is something that he does at all times for the salvation of the world at all times. That is why for those of us who live today, 2,000 years or more since the actual event, can find redemption, can find a way into God, can find a way to approach God, to be part of God, to be in the family of God, because that sacrifice that took place over 2,000 years ago is as present today as it was then. I think that's pretty cool. That's pretty cool. And then you get the resurrection. St. Paul said, if Jesus was not raised from the dead, then our faith is in vain. So that's a whole other aspect of all this. That's a whole other aspect of all this. And so the implications of what's happening in the Eucharist, what's happening in the divine liturgy or the sacred liturgy or the mass, as you might want to phrase it, has implications on how we live. And so we'll get into that down the road. Hopefully this has raised questions for you to think about. I don't claim to have all the answers. I don't even claim to explain things well. These are things that I had to deal with, that I had to wrestle with, concepts and ideas. I mean, you know, you look at, I have a degree in biology and a minor in chemistry. You know, I look at the material world in a very rational, scientific kind of a way. But we're dealing with something here that makes no sense. We're dealing with the mysteries of God. They truly are mysteries. And as human beings, we do our best to try to bridge that gap so that our minds don't just reject it out of hand, but as we are open to entertaining it, then faith has an opportunity to act. You know, and faith comes from God. Faith comes from hearing the Word of God. Jesus is the Word of God. So all these things kind of fit together. And there were many times where I'd think of stuff like the sacrifice. It took me a long time to deal with the sacrifice, that it's an unbloody sacrifice that's taking place. I didn't understand that. It's taken years to get to some understanding of that. But I was able to embrace what I could embrace and then suspend what I needed to suspend until such a time that I could embrace it. So that's been part of my journey to get there. And so that now, as I'm participating in the Mass, participating in the celebration of the Mass, I have a deeper appreciation and understanding of it. So I'll leave you with that. And, you know, it's dawned on me that I am quickly approaching the 2-year mark for this podcast, which is kind of cool. We've done it for 2 years. I've also been looking at the randomness of these episodes. And I think I've got a new appreciation for it. We're getting into spring. We're getting past the doldrums of winter. And so I will try to do these episodes more frequently. Anyway, thank you for listening, spending some time with me, putting up with me. And I look forward to sharing more of my journey with you. So until I have an opportunity to sit down and do this again, I pray that you are safe, that you're well, that you're happy, and may God bless.
This podcast is being hosted by Anchor.fm and can be found on your favorite source for podcasts. The artwork for My Life and Welcome to It is by Dave Edwards. Season 3's theme music is After All Has Changed by Humans Win, formerly Lance Conrad. If you are enjoying my adventure, you can support me by going to buymeacoffee.com/MLAWTI. 1% of all donations goes to Stripe Climate to combat climate change. You can find a list of their projects at stripe.com. Each episode of Season 3, Seeking God's Face, will appear on a random schedule. I really enjoy bringing you along on this journey called life. You can always email me at MLAWTI101@gmail.com, or you can leave me a voice message at anchor.fm. So until we meet again, be safe, be well, be happy, and God bless.